White male in the 20s or 30s. The types of weapons they use are very similar: semi-automatic handguns and AR-15 semi-automatic rifles. So, you know, we can see these kinds of things about this crime, and yet there is really no way to profile for this and to predict when it's going to happen. So I think, you know, the people I've been talking to in public health and in law enforcement are increasingly in agreement that this really is putting more pressure on the community to help watch for this problem and help intervene and try to deal with the people that are carrying out these kinds of attacks. Legislation is another question, right? I mean, we know the gun politics in this country are extremely intense, extremely polarized. It boggles the mind that this can keep happening over and over, and the conversation about gun control or gun regulations doesn't really seem to change. We hear the same arguments from both sides, and particularly from the Second Amendment people who won't have any thought of changing the regulatory system, which we know is flawed at best, to put it charitably.
Mark Fullman, we'll have to leave it there. We thank you for being with us. National Affairs Editor at Mother Jones runs Mother Jones' coverage of gun violence, including their mass shootings database, which we will link to. And that does it for the broadcast. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Nermeen Sheikh, Steve Martinez, Sam Alkopani, Masood Rabi Karen, Dina Guzder, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
KBOO Portland. The time is 5 p.m. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the 23rd annual Clinton Division Street Fair Saturday, July 25th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. with an after party on Clinton Street from 5 p.m. to 9 p.m. The community parade, Metamorphosis, will start at 10:45 a.m. There will also be artisan, craft, and community booths, sidewalk sales, live music, food, and more. Again, that's the 23rd annual Clinton Division Street Fair, Saturday, July 25th, from 10 to 5 p.m., with an after-party on Clinton Street going until 9 p.m. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the ever-present nuclear threat, Thursday, August 6th, at the Japanese American Historical Plaza at Waterfront Park in Portland. 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki will feature speakers and performers, including Portland Taiko, and will provide opportunities for attendees to get involved in efforts to abolish nuclear weapons. That's 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The ever-present nuclear threat, Thursday, August 6th, 6 p.m. at the Japanese American Historical Plaza at Northwest NATO Parkway and Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Lentz International Farmers Market, a program of Zinger Farm, every Sunday at Southeast 92nd and Foster from 10 to 3. Lentz Farmers Market offers the Food Scouts Farmers Market Club for kids, a community produce booth open to home gardeners, cooking demos, and live music. More at lentzfarmersmarket.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we'll have an update on Sandra Bland, a Black woman and activist who was found dead at a Texas county jail just days after being pulled over for a traffic stop.
Local residents organize against Shell as one of its ships comes to Portland for repairs.
And supporters for raising Oregon's minimum wage take their first step towards filing a ballot initiative.
Good Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, July 17th, 2015. I'm Liam Delta.
And I'm Linda Olson Osterlund. The death of anti-police brutality activist Sandra Bland this week while in police custody has sparked outrage across the country, as well as a disturbing hashtag now trending on Twitter. If I die in police custody is the hashtag. Using that hashtag, Black activists around the country have written chilling messages on what their friends should do if they die in police custody, like Sandra Bland. Many of the postings say they want to make sure people know that the media reports about them will be false and misleading, and that their death will not have been suicide, and any claims of suicide would be false, and that their survivors should not forgive and forget, but should get angry and demand justice. Bland died in a jail cell in Texas Monday after being arrested last Friday during a minor traffic stop. Video footage taken by a bystander shows the police forcing her to the ground and banging her head. The coroner called her death a suicide, but her supporters say she was lynched by the Texas police who arrested her. Waller County, where she died, has a long history of extreme structural racial violence, including limiting Black people from voting, and separate graveyards for Black individuals were maintained until the last decade. For more, cable reporter Catherine Matichek spoke with Carrie McLean, a lawyer and activist.
I am speaking with Carrie McLean, a human rights lawyer and activist from New York City. Thanks for being with me today, Carrie.
Thank you.
For those who may be unfamiliar with the story of Sandra Bland, could you give an overview of what happened?
Sure. Okay, at this point, not all of the details have been released, but we know that she was pulled over for some kind of minor traffic stop, something pretty basic. She and the police officer had some kind of issue. Once again, we don't know all the details, but there is a recording where we hear her yelling that he slammed her head into the ground and she wasn't able to hear. Okay, and then he took her to the jail, and then supposedly she hanged herself a few days later.
So this all happened in Waller County in Texas, and this county has a history of racism. Even a former county judge, Dwayne Charleston, described it as the most racist county in the state of Texas. Is there hope that the situation there will improve in light of this case?
You know, honestly, I don't feel that optimistic at the moment. And unfortunately, I read a news report yesterday that the sheriff in that county was fired from his last job because of racism allegations. So that definitely makes one wonder, is he going to handle this matter in a fair and transparent way?
Is this case at all reminiscent of the deaths in police custody during the civil rights era?
Oh my goodness, yes, absolutely, absolutely. I feel as if these things have been happening for generations. It's nothing new for the USA, and that's just a fact, whether or not people want to admit it. I think there's this idea that if you're this perfect person, things like that won't happen to you. But it's just not true. It's simply not true. And so you look at someone like Sandra, educated woman, professional young woman, actually on her way to go start a new job, but that didn't make any difference. You know, all the police officer saw was her blackness, and he reacted accordingly.
At what scale do you think change would have to happen to really start to improve the situation we have here?
Well, obviously there needs to be systemic change in our justice system, right? That's obvious, and that's huge. That's enormous. I think what's really important is people being out in the streets, protesting, making their voices heard. I think what we've seen that happen a lot over the past, like almost a year now, a little less than a year, just sort of these young people being out in massive numbers as part of this Black Lives Matter movement. And it is making an impact. This is progress.
You mentioned the hashtag Black Lives Matter. Another hashtag that's been trending on Twitter in light of this case is hashtag If I Die in Police Custody. What does it say about the psyche of young black people in America that these sort of things have to be said and explained?
Catherine, it's heartbreaking. Absolutely heartbreaking. And I don't know if you had the opportunity to look at some of the tweets that accompany the hashtags. It's demoralizing. And, you know, I do a lot of work overseas. I work on human rights issues overseas. And I meet people that think that America is just perfect. You know, it's the country that every country should try to strive to be like. And we have these horrific issues. You know, I can't believe that in 2015 we still have situations like this that are affecting a large segment of the population and they're not really being addressed. So we in the U.S. are guilty of gross human rights abuses.
Moving forward, what is the hope that anything will come out of this case or any progress will be made? Is there a hope? What can we expect to see over the next couple weeks?
So I'll say this, you know, just sort of on the individual level, there needs to be justice for Sandra Bland, obviously. But I hope that the attention that this case is getting will highlight that black women and girls are also dealing, coping with police violence. And I want people to really pay attention to that. You know, if you're a person of conscience, you just cannot be silent.
Thank you so much for taking time to speak with me today, Carrie.
Thanks a lot, Kathy.
I've been speaking with Carrie McLean, a human rights lawyer and activist based in New York City. This is Catherine Matichek with KBOO News.
The FBI has named the man it believes shot and killed four Marines in a recruiting office in Chattanooga, Tennessee. They've not yet identified a motive in the shooting. The alleged shooter was Mohammed Abdulaziz, 24. He was born in Kuwait but held U.S. citizenship. A recent graduate of the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, Abdulaziz was described by neighbors as a good kid from a family of good people. Abdulaziz allegedly carried an assault rifle at the time of attack and led police on a high-speed chase before engaging in a gun battle in which he was killed by police.
The U.S. Department of the Interior introduced new regulations on the controversial practice of mountaintop removal mining yesterday. The move prompted outrage from the coal industry and some from politicians. Some environmental groups cautiously praised the regulations, while others say the new rules do not go far enough. Mountaintop removal mining entails blowing the top off of a mountain using dynamite in order to reach coal reserves deep inside. For years, the resulting waste has been dumped in rivers and streams. The practice is most common in Appalachian states of Kentucky and West Virginia. The new regulations are designed to prevent this practice from poisoning the waterways used for wildlife and human consumption. But many environmental activists say they don't go far enough and that there are numerous loopholes allowing the coal industry to continue the destructive practice. Coal industry representatives decried the regulations as too costly. Senator Joe Manchin, a Democrat from West Virginia and a staunch supporter of the coal industry, vowed to have the regulations repealed. The Obama administration insists the regulations will be relatively inexpensive and should have minimal impact on employment.
Several citizens groups filed suit against the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, yesterday, alleging that long-term inaction on several complaints amounts to racial discrimination. The suit was filed on behalf of organizations including the Sierra Club Lone Star Chapter and Californians for Renewable Energy. It alleges that the EPA ignored complaints between 1994 and 2003, allowing several polluting facilities to be built near low-income communities populated mostly by people of color. Since then, several of the facilities have been classified by the EPA itself as significant violators of environmental regulations. Among the facilities cited are an ExxonMobil chemical plant in Beaumont, Texas, two gas-fired power plants in Pittsburgh, California, and a hazardous waste facility in New Mexico.
A damaged icebreaker that's essential to Shell Oil's controversial plans to drill in the Arctic this summer is heading to Portland's Vigor Industrial Shipyard for repairs. Shell says the vessel was damaged on its way from Alaska's port of Dutch Harbor to the drill site in the Chukchi Sea, about 70 miles off the coast of Alaska. Shell plans to drill two exploratory oil wells in that area this summer. Two events are taking place this weekend in Portland to organize and rally the opposition to Shell's icebreaker coming to this town. On Saturday, the Climate Action Coalition 350 PDX will hold a kickoff rally for a National Day of Action Against Shell. That event will be at Columbia Park Annex at North Willamette and Woolsey in North Portland at 11 a.m. And then on Sunday, a new group called Portland versus Shell will be meeting at City Hall at 12 noon to plan direct action for Monday when the ship is scheduled to arrive in town. We spoke with representatives of both groups about their opposition to Shell using the Port of Portland as a location to repair their icebreaker ship.
The icebreaker Seneca has a meter-long gash in its side, and it needs repairs, so it's coming to Portland to get repairs at Vigor Industrial on Swan Island. As the people in Seattle were much opposed to having the oil rig Polar Pioneer in their midst, a number of us in Portland, I probably once the larger Portland community is aware of it, there will be much concern that we are hosting a part of the oil drilling process in the Arctic. We're very much opposed to it for a number of reasons. The environmental protection of the Arctic is important for the whole world. There's definitely some potential hazards to the Arctic drilling process itself. In fact, the Interior Department's Bureau of Ocean Energy Management has said there's a 75% chance of one or more large oil spills could happen there. So that's of great concern. And then there's the overriding concern and belief that because of our serious climate issues, fossil fuels should be staying in the ground, and we should be immediately pursuing renewable mobilization for renewable energy.
Awesome.
There's a lot of reasons why there's opposition to the Arctic drilling process and to have its equipment brought into the Portland city limits. So tomorrow at 11 a.m. at Columbia Annex Park, where we're going to be is at North Willamette and North Woolsey. We'll be presenting a show of Arctic drilling resistance, solidarity. We'll share share information and ideas and plans for future events in the Portland area while we await the icebreaker to come to Portland. We just really want to spread the word on this and make people aware of Portland's connection to the Arctic drilling operations that are to go on this summer.
And can you tell me about some of the groups that are involved in... So you mentioned that the...
There's the PDX Bike Swarm. There's First Unitarian Church, their Community for Earth wing, 350 PDX, which is our local chapter of 350.org, Portland Raging Grannies, our Children's Trust, Sustainable Energy and Economy Network, also known as SEEN, Healing Our Planet Earth, also known as HOPE, Portland Rising Tide, and No Keystone XL Pledge of Resistance Portland. And we representatives have been working together on a number of things. We've done a number of projects since we began in August 2014. And we enjoy working together and sharing ideas and sharing tactics.
That was Bonnie McKinley with the Climate Action Coalition. A representative from 350 PDX has said that Senator Jeff Merkley will attend the event at Columbia Park Annex tomorrow. KBOO also spoke with Antonia Zamora with Portland versus Shell.
So tell me a bit more about, you were in Seattle, right?
Yes.
During the Kai activist protest when Shell's oil rigs were coming in.
Yeah, that is very true. I was even there at the May 16th. At the time, I didn't realize the suicide attempt of Shell's plan to do us all in with the Arctic. It became clearer with June Against Doom, some compas and real like good people on the ground trying to do the terminal work and block the workers. The real work to do it is blocking the workers not to do their job, because they got to make that ship and make everything ready to go.
Right. And so what's happening in Portland this weekend?
This weekend we're going to have a call to action Sunday at Portland City Hall, noon. And we hope to have many people there, because this is a real serious threat to everyone's life.
So can you tell me a bit more about why Portland, why this weekend? I hear that there's a ship from Shell coming in for repairs. Is that related?
Yeah, it is very related. That is why we have a call to action, because Shell's assisting icebreaker, the Finica, has experienced significant damage enough to come and turn around. They're at Dutch Harbor at this point, and they're about to be head due south at our shipyard, Portland, Swan Island.
So tell me a bit more about this ship then, because I've heard it's really pretty important to what Shell's trying to do, and Shell's trying to say, don't worry about it, it's totally safe. But what exactly went wrong with this, and why is it coming to Portland? I mean, what's going on?
Well, the significant damage it experienced trying to get into the Arctic, it experienced like a hole, like a gash, 3 feet wide and a half inch in height. So it will have to make permanent repairs to go any further. It is the tugboat for the Polar Pioneer.
So this is going to be at City Hall. It's going to be directed at Mayor Hales and the City Council. What would you like Portland to do?
We would like the whole city of Portland to send a message to Shell that way they have hurt enough people, and they will not drill oil in the Arctic, that they come to the wrong place, the Northwest, and they will not drill oil in the Arctic. Well, according to the U.S. government, there's a 75% chance of major oil spill, and according to Coast Guard Command, there's no way to clean up an oil spill in the Arctic. However, Shell has made promises they would do a better job in the Arctic. But however, again, if we look in the last 100 years of Shell's history, they have caused harm, terror, and misery to all people of the world. Places like the Peru, the Niger Delta, and even the Vietnam War, they were involved in perpetuating that war. We as people in the streets and from our communities need to put pressure on the structural government of this problem. Obama has signed the permits and everything to go to the Arctic, so we need to put pressure back on them and say, no, this is irresponsible and it's very dangerous.
So the feds can actually pull back the permits if there's enough pressure on them.
Exactly.
Great. Is there anything else that you'd like us to know or that I didn't cover? When is this happening?
Well,
when is the ship coming in?
Yeah, we're really excited. Portland versus Shell was inspired by Ideal No More Washington, and we stand behind them, and we also stand behind many people of Shell has heard from Portland versus Shell, and we invite everybody to join us.
So this is going to be Sunday at City Hall?
Sunday
at noon.
City, yes.
And where can people get more information?
You can go to Portland versus Shell Facebook, or you can email us at portlandversusshell@gmail.com. You can also Twitter us at Portland versus Shell. We can change the future. We already know our future if we don't stop it.
That was KABU speaking with Antonio Zamora of Portland versus Shell about the event coming up on Sunday at noon at City Hall. There's also the event tomorrow at 11 at the Columbia Park Annex.
SeaWorld suspended an employee after accusations that he had been caught posing as a member of People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, PETA, and attempting to incite violence. PETA officials say that the employee used a fake name and posed as a member of its organization for several years. SeaWorld did not name the suspended employee, but PETA identified him as Paul McComb, an employee in SeaWorld's Human Resources Department. He was arrested along with other animal rights activists in a 2014 protest of the Rose Parade in Pasadena, California. SeaWorld called the allegations very concerning and hired an outside firm to investigate. The company, which operates theme parks featuring marine mammals, has been under fire since at least 2013 when the documentary Blackfish alleged that poor treatment of captive orcas led to violent incidents at one of its parks.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin. This will be followed by Bread and Roses at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is sunny with a high of 99 and a low of 64. Today in history, in 1936, the Spanish Civil War began. And in 1948, Southern Democrats met to endorse the segregationist Strom Thurmond for president. The quote of the day is from Nelson Mandela, who would have turned 97 years old tomorrow. Quote, "To be free is not merely to cast off one's chains, but to live in a way that respects and enhances the freedom of others." End quote. The fight to raise Oregon's minimum wage cleared its first hurdle this week. Oregonians for 15 announced that they have enough signatures to draft the wording of the ballot and send it to the state attorney general. Opposition groups still have the chance to challenge the wording of the ballot initiative in an effort to stop the process. If supporters complete the process, they'll still need to collect 86,000 more signatures by July 1, 2016. KBOO's Alan Montesiro spoke with Jamie Partridge from Oregonians for 15. Partridge hopes that a broad coalition of support will get the ballot initiative passed.
One of the issues during the legislative session is that this piece of legislation didn't get through. What were the obstacles then, and how will you overcome them now?
Well, we had the largest number of sponsors, actual chief sponsors and sponsors of any bill on the minimum wage in the state legislature. We had a $15 phased in over 3 years bill. There was a bill for $13.50. There was a bill for $12.20. There was a bill for $10.75. None of them went anywhere. The reason being that even though the Democrats who campaigned to raise the minimum wage and got a good majority in both houses and the governorship, listened more to their big business supporters than they did to the working people that they profess to represent.
Tell me a bit more about how the effort to raise the minimum wage to $15 has been going in other cities, Seattle, for an example.
Well, the number 15 came out of the Fight for 15 fast food workers striking in New York City about 2.5 years ago, and it spread like wildfire across the country. I mean, 2.5 years ago, people were saying, well, that, you know, sounds nice, but what a dream. People, fast food and other workers, low-wage workers, started striking in places like St. Louis and Chicago and swept across the country, and there were massive multiple city strikes. In fact, the latest on April 15th, 250 cities, tens of thousands of low-wage workers striking. But as we would suspect, and as all the past studies have shown, when the minimum wage is raised, even when it's raised sharply over a short period of time, everybody benefits. There's much more money in circulation, and which means that businesses have more customers and are actually able to add more employees. There's a rise in employment, and there's a decrease in business failures. People should go to our website, oregonians415.org, to get involved with the ballot initiative. There's a larger coalition, which is not only working on the policy, but helping any group of workers that's trying to get $15 an hour, whether they're organized or a union or not. 15 now, Oregon. oregonians15.org.
I'm talking with Jamie Partridge with Oregonians for 15. This is Alan Montecelio with KBOO News.
Oregon Governor Kate Brown signed a bill into law today that will allow thousands of Oregon high school graduates to attend community college for free. Senate Bill 81 provides free and reduced tuition to eligible students attending community colleges. The bill could serve as many as 6,000 students next year. Eligible students must apply to community college within 6 months of graduating high school and must have a GPA of at least 2.5 to qualify. Governor Brown signed the bill at Columbia Gorge Community College in Hood River today.
To deal with the ongoing water crisis in California, Governor Jerry Brown has proposed spending up to $50 billion to pipe water from the Sacramento River to Southern California for agricultural use. But a coalition of environmental groups have put together an alternative plan that will cost less than $1 billion and will save a huge amount of water in the process, instead of further depleting an already overused river. For more, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Tom Stokely of the California Water Impact Network.
What do you think is wrong with Governor Brown's plan, and what's the alternative?
Well, Governor Brown's plan isn't going to help California in a drought like this. It's a new pipe. It's a new way to send the water south, but it doesn't create any more water. And we all know that California is in the midst of a major drought. We think, among other things, that the governor should be promoting retirement of what we call poison land in the western San Joaquin Valley. This is land that the taxpayers have paid hundreds of millions of dollars to build the federal Central Valley Project to provide irrigation water to areas such as Westlands Water District. The soils there have naturally occurring selenium, boron, salt, and other minerals and metals. And so we think the land, the poison land, should be bought out and essentially the amount of water associated with that land taken off the books to reduce the demand for water in California.